Berger versus Xerox Retirement. Counsel, the panel has examined the proper demonstrative exhibit and has concluded that it would not be helpful. So we will not use that in arguments. May proceed, Mr. Pope.
May it please the court. My name is Rick Potler. I am from the law firm of Thompson Coburn in St. Louis, Missouri, and with me at council table is my partner, Lewis Mills, and together we have the privilege of representing the appellant, the Xerox Retirement Income Guarantee Plan, in this case. It is undisputed, Your Honors, that in this case the plan was properly administered in accordance with its terms, and it is undisputed that the plan paid everything to participants that it promised in accordance with its express terms that it would pay as an accrued benefit. The district court, however, adopted a new definition of accrued benefit that is not found in the plan. All of the court's district court's rulings are premised upon that newly created definition of accrued benefit. The court found a, quote, forfeiture because the plan paid what it promised it would pay and did not pay what the district court's new definition of accrued benefit
required.
I didn't
understand, actually, from your briefs what your position was. I'm looking at this IRS notice 96.8, and it talks about the cash balance plan, and it describes something that looks exactly like your plan. Future interest credits to an employee's hypothetical account balance are not conditioned upon future service. So when an employee terminates, interest credits will continue to be credited to that employee's hypothetical account until age 65, if they want to take an annuity at age 65. And then, so this is a front-loaded cash balance plan that 96.8 discusses, and under such a plan, you have to, if the person leaves early and wants a lump sum, you have to give him a lump sum that's the actuarial equivalent of the annuity that he could ask for as an alternative, you know, waiting until he's 65. So why doesn't that just end your case right there?
Thank you, Your Honor, for asking that question, because it is the critical issue in this case. And 96.8 does not address a plan such as ours. And the reason for that is
that I don't understand.
Okay.
Because what 96.8 says is it defines a cash balance plan, and it says there are two types. They're front-loaded if you continue to be entitled to these interest credits after you leave work. And then anything else, if you're not entitled, that's back-loaded, and they say that's illegal. So it seems to be that the only cash balance plan that they permit, you know, it's tax qualified and so on, is a front-loaded plan, which seems to be exactly what your plan is. Because if I work for Xerox and I quit at age 45, and I'm entitled to claim an annuity that'll begin, say, at 65, or it could be 60 or what have you, and in that period between 45 and, say, 65, obviously I'm not getting any salary from Xerox, so I'm not getting this percentage of salary added to the hypothetical account, but I'm getting these future interest credits. And that's my entitlement, that's my accrued benefit, and if I want to take this instead in a lump sum, I'm entitled to the actuarial equivalent.
Okay. I'd love to explain this, because this is critical. that you understand why what 96.8 is talking about does not apply to our plan. And it's going to take me a few minutes to do that. 96.8 is talking about what is a purely front-loaded plan. And it was written in 1996 before a lot of cash balance plans had evolved into what we call a hybrid plan. But under 96.8, they're saying that when Judge Posner gets $5,000 towards his CBRA account in 1990, it immediately, at that point, accrues all future interest credits to age 65 at that interest crediting rate. That's not what our plan says. We're not that type of a plan. What our plan says is that you will get interest at the interest crediting rate until the day you take a distribution.
Precisely. And if I got it, wait a second, because I really have been baffled by your brief. So let me make sure you understand what my problem is. If I decide, having quit at age 45, that I want to have an annuity beginning when I'm 65, that's my distribution. That's when the distribution is going to be made. And I will be entitled to these future interest credits until 65. That's my accrued benefit. If I want a lump sum now, I want a lump sum that's the actuarial equivalent of that accrued benefit.
And you are entitled to that. But what we say is you're going to get the T-bill rate plus 100 basis points from the day that money goes into your account until you take a distribution. And then from that date of distribution, we are going to project a different
interest rate. But wait a second. If I ask for the annuity, I'm 45, I want the annuity to begin when I'm 65.
Yes, sir.
That's when the distribution occurs. That's my accrued benefit to an annuity, and I'm entitled to a lump sum that's the actuarial equivalent.
You have
done this T-bill rate plus 1%.
Your Honor, if you wait and don't take any distribution until age 65, then yes, you will get that money, and each year you will be credited with the interest crediting rate applicable for that year. But that's not what we're talking about in this case.
That's exactly what 96.8 says. That is what I can claim. I can say I'm going to delay the distribution till age 65 when I get my annuity. But I want the lump sum equivalent now because it's an accrued benefit. I'm entitled to the lump sum.
Your Honor.
That's what they say. You're entitled to the lump sum.
Your Honor,
if you fit the definition of a front-loaded cash balance plan, you're in 96.8.
We are not a front-loaded
cash balance plan. What is it in the language of your plan that takes you out of 96.8?
Because our plan says that from the date the money goes in until the date of distribution, you will get the interest crediting rate.
Precisely, and the date of distribution is the date of age 65 if what you want is that annuity.
No, sir, Your Honor. The problem is at the age of 45, I may have worked at Xerox for 20 years. At age 45, I may want a lump sum distribution at that time. How do you calculate what the lump sum value is of your accrued benefit at age
45? 96.8, when do you think, when they talk about the lump sum to which you're entitled, what are they saying about someone who, forget about your plan, under their plan, if you're 45 and you quit, you have the annuity entitlement, but you can also get a lump sum.
Yes, sir.
Now, isn't 96.8 about how to compute that lump sum?
Under a plan that is purely front-loaded, such as described in 96.8, not a plan such as our plan.
But your plan differs from the front-loaded plan described in 96.8 only in that it doesn't give the cash the lump sum equivalent. That is, its only difference is it's been drafted to violate 96.8.
No, sir, Your Honor. Because here's the point. I think we're in agreement that ERISA allows the plan in a defined benefit context to define what the accrued benefit is. And it is clear that if somebody decides to take that accrued benefit in a lump sum, we do indeed have to give the actuarial equivalent of that amount in a lump sum. So then we have to look at our plan and say, how does the Xerox plan define what the accrued benefit is? It says you get win rate, T-bill plus 100, from the date the money goes into your CBRA until your date of distribution. And then it says from that date forward, you take the PBGC rate plus mortality. Put those two together and you get what the accrued benefit is at age 65. And then we have to discount that back to the date the person takes the distribution to get the lump sum. That's what we do. It is absolutely perfectly legal. There is absolutely nothing in the vesting statute of 203A, which is all the district court relied upon.
Now, are you talking about after 65 now?
No.
But between 45 and 65...
I do give them interest credits, Your Honor, but right. I give it to them at a different rate than they got while the money was still in the account. That's the distinction between the T-bill plus 100 points and the PBGC plus mortality.
Wait, I don't understand it. If you quit at 45...
Yes.
And you're and you decide you want an annuity at 65, between 45 and 65, you'll be getting those future interest credits.
If you leave your money in the account between 45 and 65, you will continue to get interest credit at the interest crediting rate. No, it isn't, Your Honor, because the difference is that in a purely front-loaded plan, on day one, when that $5,000 goes into your account, you apply the interest crediting rate all the way age 65 immediately, so that $5,000...
But that's what you do.
No, it isn't, Your Honor. That's what I keep trying to explain is we don't go from the date the money goes into the account to age 65. We go from that date and say, all right, if this gentleman at the age of 25 takes an immediate distribution, we're going to project it out at the PBGC plus mortality, get an accrued
but 65. But if he doesn't, if he's content to leave the money in until age 65,
yes,
then he gets his future interest credits.
He
and that's an accrued benefit, and the question is, what is its lump sum equivalent?
Each year he
can't get beyond that.
Each year he would get an additional interest credit. That is correct. But he's not immediately entitled to it at the interest crediting rate. Under our plan, under 96A, he would be, but not under ours.
After 5 years, if his benefits are vested, and if he decides to leave the money in, as you put it, not take a lump sum distribution,
okay,
then he has an indefeasible entitlement to an annuity at 65, which will reflect the intermediate years of future credit.
Absolutely. But what happens, Your Honor, when he says, I'm not staying to 65, I want my money at 45?
What he's saying is, I want the lump sum equivalent of my accrued benefit.
But, Your Honor, you have to look at the plan to see how the accrued benefit is defined.
No, because what the plan can't do is say that you get a smaller lump sum benefit than the actuarial value of your accrued benefit.
Absolutely, Your Honor, but see, the problem is you've imposed upon us, just as the district court, an accrued benefit that is not provided for in our plan.
But the accrued benefit, well, we're going in, sir. I don't understand you, so forget about it. Let me ask you a completely different question. I don't understand the discussion in either your brief or your opponent's brief of the class action, the 23B2 issue. 23B2 says you can have a class action with no opt-out if you seek injunctive or declaratory relief based on an issue common to the whole class. They're seeking a declaration that your way of calculating the lump sum is invalid as to everybody in the plan. Why isn't that a perfectly good request for declaratory relief? Having nothing to do with the cases that deal with, you know, what a fiduciary can sue for, anything like that, it doesn't have to be injunctive in character, it's just a declaration.
Because, Your Honor, this, at its bottom line, no matter how you want to couch it, is a typical 502B claim to collect additional benefits.
It's a perfectly typical 25B2. I didn't see you citing anything which says this is not an appropriate 25. I don't remember your citing cases about,
Your Honor,
I mean 23, not 25, sorry.
Your Honor, what we say is that this is a 502b1 claim for benefits. It is not a 502(3) claim for other equity.
Look at 23b2. It says the party opposing the class, your plan, your client, has acted or refused to act on grounds generally applicable to the class, thereby making appropriate final injunctive relief or corresponding declaratory relief with respect to the class, therefore making appropriate final injunctive relief or corresponding declaratory relief with respect to the class as a whole. In other words, the grounds, your interpretation of your plan and of the law creates a ground for the lawsuit that's equally applicable to everybody in the case. Of course, it has financial implications. That's frequently true. But why is it perfectly appropriate for 23b2 treatment?
Because, Your Honor, I don't think this is fairly an.
I don't think. Do you have a case which says, no, you can't have 23b2 class action in this kind of case?
Well,
did you cite anything under 23b2? I don't remember you discussing anything to do with class action law.
Well, we did cite the Jefferson case.
What's that about?
The Jefferson International, in which I think that the court, we also cited the Brunghetti case, which addresses a different issue, the fact that the two named plaintiffs are entitled to absolutely nothing.
That's a completely different issue.
I understand that, Your Honor, but the other issue is the Jefferson case, which I think it says that if you may proceed under that type of...
Where's the Jefferson? Jefferson versus Ingersoll?
Yes, sir. And it says you may proceed that if the monetary damages are incidental. And I don't think that the monetary damages here are incidental. I think that they are the heart and soul of this case. And that from the very beginning, we've known that what they're really attempting to get are additional accrued benefits.
You discussed this in the context of say the district court didn't follow Jefferson. What did the district court say? You didn't discuss that.
The district court basically said that this was injunctive relief and therefore it was going to
apply. Irrelevant. It's the question is, does this make sense for a declaration?
I don't believe that it does.
Why not?
Because I think what they are attempting to get are a recalculation of benefits for each individual person, saying, just as any other ERISA case, you pay me $100 in medical benefits, and I think I should have gotten $150 in medical benefits.
Very different, because that's a case that involves, you know, an individual determination of, you know, the application of the plan to an individual. Here, you and they are making a general legal argument about the legality of the plan itself, of this cash balance plan.
The issue ought to be how you determine a person's accrued benefit under the terms of the plan, just as you determine whether something's experimental under the plan or not, and therefore whether they're entitled to benefit.
So Jefferson is it? That's your one case?
I believe so, Your Honor. If I may, I'd like to go back to the accrued benefit because it is such a critical point.
Well, it is,
and I'm baffled that I can't explain it.
Let me throw this out. As you're talking with Judge Posner, discussing with Judge Posner, aren't you imposing a penalty on somebody at age 50, 45 who wants to take that lump sum?
No.
Because it doesn't apply. That calculation does not apply and never will apply to the person who takes it at 65.
But first of all, Your Honor, do you know that in most of these individuals, that stressed in 1990, if they had left their money in all the way to 65, their accrued benefit would have been less than we paid them. And the reason for that is that the interest crediting rate went down below
what the projection is. Well, I know, but that's a really bad argument, because that's like saying, Well, actually, the lump sum, we only give people $2, but if he'd used his $2, taken his $2 and bought a lottery ticket and won a lottery ticket, he'd be even better. The point is, the people have an entitlement. They choose. They take the lump sum, and they might take the lump sum, if it were the correct amount, and invest it and do, you know, terrifically.
But, Your Honor, they have an entitlement to that accrued benefit only if it is provided in our plan, or if the law imposed that accrued benefit on our plan, saying that our accrued benefit was illegal and because we violated the backloading rules or the accrual rules. That's what happened in Edison. That's not our case.
Let me ask the question differently. What do you mean when you call this a hybrid balance plan?
Because rather than being purely front-loaded, where on day one, the person accrues the interest credits all the way to age 65, automatically, immediately, can never be taken away. That's what 96-8 is. Or it might be a plan that you only get that credit year to year, that he wouldn't get the credit from age 45 to 46 until 46. That's a backloading plan. That's what 96 says. You know, if you do that, you might have backloading problems under Section 204. We don't do either one of those things, because what we do is we say you will get the interest crediting rate from year to year till your date of distribution, and then we will project that lump sum, that sum in your CBER account, out to age 65 at the projection rate. There's nothing wrong with
it. I don't understand. But that means that if you wait till 65, you get all your future credits.
But, Your Honor, you will get all of the credits under our plan. It's just that we define our accrued benefit differently.
That's the penalty.
It is no penalty.
Well, I mean, let me call it a penalty. You call it something else, but you're paying them differently for that period of time at a rate theoretically advantageous to zero.
You might argue that, but
well, I am. I mean, that's the point, and that's what I consider to be the penalty. If the guy goes from 25 to 65, he gets everything accrued to that point. But if he takes it at 45, you say, well, we're going to calculate it differently.
But, Your Honor, at age 45, how are you going to know what the interest crediting rate is going to have been over the next 20 future years in order to determine what that amount will be at age 65? You can't know it. It's an unknowable.
Well, this 96-8 deals with that.
No, Your Honor, because that, again, doesn't have to address that issue, because those plans immediately give him the entire interest crediting rate automatically to age 65. That's not what our plan says. And you look at the district court's order, and you find where he says the way Xerox's plan defines accrued benefit violates the law. You won't find it, because it doesn't. What Esden did is they said, this plan violates the law, we're going to reform it. Here, the judge reformed it without having ever found any violation of ERISA, the statutory sections, and I will represent to the court, it does not violate any section of ERISA. There is no violation. There is no basis for reforming it, for imposing upon this plan a different accrued benefit than it spells out. We made a promise. We lived up to that promise, and that promise does not in any way, shape, or form violate the law, and there's not a statute.
But your promise was to pay a lump sum that wouldn't be the actuarial equivalent of their annuity.
It is the actuarial. How do you calculate that annuity, Your Honor, at age 65? Our plan tells you how to do that. Does the way our plan tell you to do it in any way violate the law or any case decision? No, it does not.
It seems to violate 96.8.
If it were the kind of plan that is described in 96.8, it might, Your Honor.
But it describes something which is your plan. Say the front-loaded interest credit plan that specifies a variable outside index for use in determining the amount of interest credits. That's what you do.
No.
Yes, you specify a variable outside index.
Yes, but we do
bill
not.
Plus 1% must prescribe the method for reflecting future interest credits in the calculation of an employee's accrued benefit.
Yes. And then it says in that, the plans we're talking about,
and if, and in determining the amount of the accrued benefit, a forfeiture will result if the value of the future interest credits is projected using a rate that understates the value of those credits. Or if the plan by its turn reduces the interest rate or rate of return used for projecting future interest credit, which seems to be exactly what you
mean. No, Your Honor. Here, if our plan said, Judge Posner, you're 25, you get $5,000, we will credit you right now with the full interest credit to age 65 at 8%, and you decide to take a lump sum distribution at age 45, under what 96.8 says is we couldn't penalize you and say, all right, we're only going to give you 4% from that point forward.
Exactly.
But our plan never makes the promise to give you that interest crediting rate all the way to age 65.
1% till 65.
No.
That's the promise.
No, till date of distribution, Your Honor.
But I can decide the date of distribution will be 65.
And if you do, Your Honor, then that's the amount we will give to you. But that's not the issue we have here today.
It's absurd kind of semantic gibberish that you're pushing on us. It's ridiculous.
Is your position that distribution is the date of the lump sum?
Absolutely. The date of distribution is the date the person elects the lump sum.
And you think the plan is specific on that?
Absolutely.
What if you took distribution at age 64 plus 11 months or 65? There's a substantial difference then, right?
No, probably won't be. Because you're going to get the interest credits at the interest and crediting rate to age 64 in 11 months, and then we're going to project one more rate of interest at the PBGC rate. It's going to be a minuscule difference.
Well, but there is a difference, and the reason there's a difference is I call a penalty, you call it the part of the plan, but for any time as you keep moving that back from age 65, it's a different rate than would have been paid at 65.
If the person had kept their money in throughout the entire time to 65, we define the accrued benefit differently. Yeah, I mean, we provide an express definition of accrued benefit, which is purely compliant with the law, and we live up to that. Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Freeman. May it please the Court. In response to Your Honor's questions, the plan violates Section 203A because it works a forfeiture by not giving a retiree who chooses a lump sum distribution the actuarial equivalent of the accrued benefit that he has expressed as annual benefit payment commencing at the normal retirement age or his normal retirement benefit. The position that the Xerox plan took in this court is the position it's taken throughout these proceedings, which is why which answers most of the other issues they raise about the district court's remedy and the choice of remedy. They insist that the plan trumps the statute and that they are entitled to distribute the lump sum in the participant's account balance at the date he chooses to take a distribution. And that is contrary to what 96.8 states, but beyond that, 96-8, Your Honor, just summarizes the Treasury regulations that were promulgated earlier, that were the subject of substantial consideration in 1991, finally enacted in 1993, as Esden points out, and reflect the statement of the law as it existed when this plan was adopted. There's no surprise to this plan when this plan was amended to become a cash balance plan. The argument made by the Xerox plan in this case is the exact argument that was made in the Esden case. And the Esden court thoroughly reviewed the applicable law, held that in Esden, the plan sought to accomplish the same thing, to give the participant the amount in his cash balance account by simply projecting at a low rate and a rate that was below the PBGC rate
so that it always ended up at the cash balance. And the Essen court said, you can't do that. You have to project at the rate specified in the plan. And the rate specified in this plan is the one-year treasury bill plus 1%. The Essen court went further and said, on the basis of the treasury regulations that are in effect, the choice of the rate to use can be either the rate that was in effect at the time the person retired, that is, at the time took his distribution. If he took a distribution in 1994, he gets that rate, the one-year T-bill at that point, plus 1%, projected out to age 65, and then discounted back at the PBGC rate to reflect the present value. Or he can get, as in court says, and says the regulations are reasonable, he can get the average of the five prior years. In this case, the plaintiffs proposed an average of the five prior years, but that would have been larger than the rate the judge chose. The rate the judge chose was the rate in effect at the time each of the participants retired.
I just say, as I understand it, and the argument is, they're able to define it and not violate the law or the regs in a way they have and describe it in two different rates.
Well, first of all, this court is, it can't do that. This court held that as been addressed exactly that argument. Second of all, then if you read closely, their initial brief said there were no credits after a person terminated employment under 18.4. When we showed that was improper, they then picked internal crediting rate up to time of distribution, and then the PBGC rate above that. It's a charade. The choice, what they're trying to do is just project up at the PBGC rate because they have to discount back at the PBGC rate, always ends up at the account balance rate. And that's exactly the example. I mean, it's in numbers. That's the example in Notice 96-8, the example of why that is improper. If there is a rate specified in the plan, that is the rate that has to be used to project up all the way to age 65. You can't pick different plateaus. And that's the same thing that the 11th Circuit held in Lyons. In Lyons, the rate in the plan was the PBGC rate plus 0.75 basis points. And the Lyons court held you simply have to use that rate to project up to age 65. You can't pick any other rate because that's the rate specified in the plan. Now, the plan could...
Their argument is that we can formulate the rates however we want.
Well, that's true. They could have said, first of all, we won't give you a lump sum. They could have also said, and in that case, they wouldn't have to pay a lump sum. They could also have adopted a plan which paid a lower rate. But once they adopt that rate, and once a person retires and his benefit is accrued, the law provides that your benefit is accrued. It's vested, it's accrued. And it's a term of art, as this court held in Hickey. Once that benefit is accrued, you necessarily have to project that benefit up to age 65 to determine the annuity at the rate that's promised. You can't change the rate with hindsight. You can't change the rate to work this kind of forfeiture. And that's exactly what 96.8 says. You can't and in Lyons, you can't change the rate afterwards to work a forfeiture. You had a question?
What remains, if anything, to be done in the district court? Does the actual entitlement of each of the members of the class have to be determined? Is that mechanical?
No. It has already been determined. There was one loose end in the district court, and that was whether or not every single class member had been identified, because the information used for the judge's calculations came from Xerox. But it appears that they all have been identified. There was so all class members have been identified, and their entitlement to additional benefits, if any, has been calculated. In answer to your question, though, Your Honor, on page 30 of our brief, we do argue that the relief sought was equitable and was a declaratory relief as to the participants' rights to have their distributions calculated according to ERISA's requirements. And in order
does
to
that matter? I mean, you know a lot more about class action than I do, but is it proper under 23b2 to have a declaration with regard to an entitlement, even though the only function of the declaration is to translate that entitlement into a dollar amount?
Oh yes, I think absolutely. We cite the Piazza case from the Sixth Circuit, which reversed the district judge for certifying a 23b3 class in that situation, saying it had to be a 23b2. And then the Jefferson decision addresses this issue and says that a 23b2 class is appropriate when you're seeking a declaration and incidental damages. And this court has, in Lemon, has cited the Allison case out of the Fifth Circuit, which defines incidental as flowing from the declaration. Incidental is also a term of art. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't mean trivial. It
doesn't mean trivial.
It means the consequence.
The Allison case, the Allison decision expressly addressed that and said incidental is what flows from the declaration. The amount of the money, it doesn't depend on the amount. And Judge Canty was on the panel in Jefferson, and Jefferson discusses this at length and draws the distinction between just this case we have, and as a matter of fact, Esden was a B2 case rule. Esden
was also
with a rule.
Is there some reason why the administrator wasn't sued? The plan is sued here, right?
Well, they tried to sue. The administrator kept changing. There were two administrators.
The person who was the administrator kept changing?
Yes. The administrator was dismissed twice because the administrator kept changing.
I understand. So the permanent officers have changed too, but is there some reason why you wouldn't pursue the administrator, whoever he or she may be?
Well, under the decisions of this court, we don't think it's necessary. I mean, this court has held in Garrett. We cite the cases. Garrett, that the plan is the proper defendant, and that the plan simply has to find a means to effectuate the judgment. Garrett is the leading decision. You wrote the opinion,
right?
And also Numa Inc., where Judge Canty sat. But both of those cases, the Seventh Circuit says the plan is a proper defendant, and in some circumstances where the plan and the corporation are intertwined, you can also sue the corporation. But there's no hint that the administrator is a necessary party.
Could you say something about the interplay between the cash balance plan and the TRA? I mean, I understand the basic principle of a floor offset arrangement, but in computing your damages, what assumption did you make about did the TRA require any kind of computation or projection?
Well, the only place in which that came into became significant in computation of damages was the determination whether to use 120% or 100% of the PBGC rate in discounting back to present value, and the statute provides that for amounts over $25,000 you use 120%, for amounts under $25,000 you use 100%. We contended, as a floor offset plan works, that if you had $50,000 in your TRA and you had $60,000 in your CBRA, that the amount you should look at for determining whether to apply that 120% or the 100% is the amount that the defined benefit portion contributes to the total benefit.
You mean the $10,000?
The $10,000. You would look at the $10,000 because the $50 already belongs to the employee. It's a little more complicated than that because you project up and you compare the value of the annuities at age 65, which the law requires. But that's the basic principle.
So is that what the judge did?
That's what the judge did. He offset the TRA against the CBRA.
Jim, could you speak to Xerox's position on the mortality rates that they don't accrue?
It's just wrong. The plan in Section 7 provides that the spouse gets the full retirement benefit of any participant who dies. So the spouse steps into the participant's shoes, and in that circumstance, we cited the Crosby case out of the Western District of Michigan, that there is no need to apply a mortality decrement because it will never happen as long as the person has a spouse. There is a mortality calculation in terms of valuing the age 65 annuity. You look at how long people live after 65, but in terms of up to 65, no, because the spouse or the person to whom the beneficiary of the participant has exactly the same benefits as the participant under Section 7.4 and 7.3.
There's a secondary beneficiary in addition.
Yeah.
No spouse or another beneficiary.
Yeah. And I think the position taken by Xerox here at this argument demonstrates the wisdom of the district court in not requiring exhaustion of remedies, and plus as your honors have held, that's a decision well within the district court's discretion, and it would be futile here because all the facts have been developed. There are no factual issues. There's no question as to what the plan provides. They say that you have to apply the plan. We say that if you apply the plan, it's illegal. It's a legal question. And so it would have been futile to require exhaustion of remedies, especially with the adamant position taken by Xerox. I think the only other issue, there is the issue as to the impact of this case on other. They raise it in the brief. That's a total red herring. These regulations have been in effect since 1991. They're specific, as Ezencourt notes, they're specific safe harbors.
Well, but apparently, I suppose really, Mr. Poplar is more appropriate answers, but apparently the lawyers or accountants thought up this hybrid plan at some point. But they didn't get a letter from the IRS or anything, did they?
No, but a letter in terms of
saying this is okay. It's not a front-loaded plan. It's not 96.8.
No, they didn't get a letter. But even if they had, the Ezencourt said that kind of letter doesn't have any relevance to the issue posed by whether the plan affects a forfeiture when it shortchanges a lump sum distributee. If the court has no further questions, we will stand on our papers.
Did you want to ask?
Yeah.
Well, your time has expired, but you may have a minute if there's some response you want to a particular point.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll have to be very quick. First of all, Your Honor, yes, before the district court, there were determination letters showing that our plan was perfectly qualified exactly as it was written. Number two, I would ask the court to look at Section 411.
You got a letter from the IRS?
Yes, and it was before the district court. It's not a part of the appendix, but it was before the district court. Second, Your Honor, I would ask you please to look at Section 411C2. It is a plan by statute that does exactly what our plan does. It gives one interest rate up to the date of distribution and a different rate, in fact, the very rate we use, for the period from distribution to age 65. It is a government plan. I mean, it's statutory that you can do that. Now, it's talking about employee contributions, not employer, but it's the exact same concept that we use. And so it's even better than an IRS determination letter. It's a congressional statute.
No, no, but it doesn't apply. Do you have any comment about 204C3? This is the statute that says if an employee's accrued benefit is to be determined as an amount other than an annual benefit commencing at normal retirement age, that's a description of your plan, the employee's accrued benefit shall be the actuarial equivalent of such benefit.
Yes. And it says that you projected out at the 417E rate.
Doesn't say it in 204C3. Maybe it says it somewhere else.
But see, Your Honor, the problem is that when you take that distribution at age 45, how are we going to predict what the interest crediting rates would have been for the next 20 years?
Well, there are these alternatives. One is you could use the current interest rate on the theory that the current interest rate is an unbiased predictor of future rates.
Yes.
And you could do that.
Yes.
And another way, some average of the last 5 years or something.
Yes, and you could also use the PBGC rate, which
but
is not an
incredible predictor. That is not an unbiased predictor of future T-bill plus 1% rates, right?
It is a predictor of
rates. Look, future interest credits are defined as the T-bill, 1 year T-bill plus 1%. Mm-hmm. The best prediction of what those varying rates will be in the future. Well, I probably best predict could be the current rate, or it could be a long-term T-bill rate, could be something, but it's not the PBGC rate.
Well, Your Honor, I disagree for two reasons, because first of all, the PBGC is what is used to predict future interest credits under all of ERISA, for number one, and number two, when you look at what happened, it turned out to be a far better predictor as a matter of fact than what if we had used the interest crediting rate. I mean, does anybody think that in 1990...
Right, if you'd used the interest crediting rate, you wouldn't have this legal problem.
And if the law obligated us to do so, we would have done so. But that's the whole point. The law doesn't impose that obligation upon us.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thanks, Alder. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.